something that you do that might seem very, very insignificant or trivial can actually mean the world to someone else. I think that's what those people are talking about, is those moments.
This is the Cracking Creativity Podcast, episode number 36 with Brandon Lee. Welcome to the Cracking Creativity Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Chung, and I'm here to show you how creatives turn their ideas into action, create interesting projects, and build an engaged audience through shared passions. Now let's get creative. In this episode of the Cracking Creativity Podcast, I talked to Brandon Lee, who is an entrepreneur and writer. He has been featured on Times, Mashable, and is a lead writer on Quora. After spending 3 years as an international speaker for nonprofits and churches, he reinvented himself and became a real estate investor. In this episode, Brandon talks about how he reinvented himself, making an impact, and the role of mentorship and how it helped him. Now on to the episode. Welcome to another episode of Cracking Creativity. Today I'm on Brandon Lee, who is a real estate investor. He is a top Quora writer who has written about careers, entrepreneurship, people skills. I could name the list forever because you've written about so many topics. You've been featured on Time and Mashable. You also do speaking. Brandon, can you tell us how you got into all these different things and what you're kind of doing right now?
How I got into all these things. I think in general, it's just exploring little passions. I mean, I think a lot of people struggle with the fact that, like, when they're breaking into something new, they struggle with their identity in a sense. It's like, am I an investor? Like, for example, I'm in real estate right now. It's like, am I a real estate investor when I decide to get my feet wet in it, or am I a real estate investor after I've done it for 3 months, or am I an investor after I've done it for a year? And then, like, similarly, when I'm, you know, writing on Quora, it's like I never identified myself as a writer. I just started writing, and then it wasn't until Quora called me, like, told me that I was a top writer that, oh, I started calling myself, oh yeah, I'm a writer on Quora too. Like, I don't self-identify as a writer. I don't self-identify as a real estate investor. These are sort of just things that I'm currently doing, and it's just convenient for me to position myself in certain ways. But at the end of the day, what I'm doing is I'm just pursuing things that I'm interested in and things that sort of fall in line with my life vision or my interests. And as I develop them, I just, you know, it's just part of what I do. But people like to slap labels on who I am or how I function, and people like titles, and it's convenient for building an audience and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, for me, it's just, you know, pursue what I'm interested in and what falls in line with my why, and then that's how I get into those things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was the beginning of your journey? Like, when you were growing up, what did you want to do, and how did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, so, yeah, those early journey, beginning stories. Right. I grew up in the Silicon Valley. My parents put me in a lot of extracurriculars. I mean, I was always in sports as a kid. I thought when I was five that I was going to play soccer for the rest of my life. Ended up playing soccer all throughout my teenage years. And that was in part what I identified with. Like, when people said, what do you like to do? Well, I just played soccer for years, so just soccer was, like, my default answer. Yeah, even in school, I wasn't that stellar in academics, and that sort of frowned upon based on where I grew up, because I grew up in the heart of Silicon Valley, and I went to a very academically achieving school, and so that was sort of, my parents were always bragging about my grades, but I didn't really care, because I just wanted to play soccer and have fun and whatnot. But, and I mean, if you look back on my transcript or get a snapshot of the kind of person that I was in high school, I wasn't standout in any kind of way. Like, I was a band geek. I played trumpet, but I wasn't like first chair musician or something. You know, I studied calculus in high school, but like, I wasn't one of those overachievers that studied calc when they were like a freshman or a sophomore in high school. I mean, I did a lot of things as like an Asian kid in Silicon Valley, but like I was not standout in many, many regards. So it wasn't really until, I guess, college when you start asking yourself all those hard questions like, who am I, what do I want to do with my life, and what defines me? I think that's when I started learning how to speak for myself and think for myself. And it wasn't really until then that I just, you know, dared to do things because I wanted to, as opposed to what everyone else is doing, what I was told I should be doing, what is socially appropriate, et cetera, et cetera. So that was, yeah, that's how it started. Hmm. Yeah.
What's the first thing that you did after graduating?
So after graduating, so up to that point, like junior, senior year, that's when everyone's doing college apps and stuff like that. And so almost half of my friends went to, almost all my friends either went to Berkeley or UCLA or one other, another UC in the California university system. And I ended up going to De Anza, which is a local community college, because I had no clue what I was doing. And I didn't think it made sense to burn through my parents' money when I had no idea what I was doing. So when I first got to college, it was just, I'm just going to take a bunch of general classes to figure out who the heck I am and what the heck I want to do with the rest of my life. And yeah, it took maybe like 3 years to figure it out. But yeah, that's how it started.
Do you think it was beneficial to take that route as opposed to going to a state university?
That's what worked for me. I mean, at the end of the day, this isn't a prescription. This is just my story. And for me, just the way I functioned is I knew that if I went to UC, I would have been just conforming to the mold that was presented in front of me. And I wouldn't have, like, I applied to UCs just because everyone else is applying to UCs. I would have went to that college or the UC system because everyone else was. So I probably would have taken a major that everyone else would have taken and just did things simply because everyone else was doing it. And I think for me at that time, I understood the value for thinking. I don't know if I understood it. I think I just intuitively was very uncomfortable with constantly doing what everyone else was doing. So I just felt like I had to find an environment where I could learn to hear myself think, so to speak. And so I don't think it's whether it was a smart thing or not a smart thing. I just couldn't live with myself trying to like live up to everyone else's standards. I didn't like, you know, conforming my life to all these socially imposed standards. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess I was pretty self-aware as a 19-year-old.
That's pretty rare for somebody to have. It took you 3 years to graduate from a community college.
I didn't finish.
Oh, you didn't finish. you're still thinking about things.
I didn't finish.
Okay. So how do you go from there into...
there into what
real,
I'm doing now.
Real estate investment, yeah.
Okay. So after a year of community college, I transferred to a private university up in Reading called Simpson University, and I was there for one semester, and then I dropped out. Hmm. I dropped out because I ended up, at the time, I started working with a couple churches in that area, and basically I got the chance to help people in a significant way that impacted both the people I was helping and myself. Like, you know how people talk about like, oh, like if you're ever stuck in a rut, like just go help someone. And in my opinion, what they're really getting at is those moments where something that you do that might seem very, very insignificant or trivial can actually mean the world to someone else. I think that's what those people are talking about, is those moments, because that's exactly what I encountered when I started working with those churches, where, you know, just even, you know, spending time with someone who feels invisible, who feels like they're like a social leper forgotten by society, and you take the time to sit with them for 10 minutes and just to hear the story and like the gratitude that they have in their eyes because of that, or you just sharing one little piece of insight that you learned over the years but this person was struggling with it, and it was just racking their mind, and they were just going through so much stress because of it. And this one casual insight, seemingly casual insight, completely transforms their life. And they're, like, overwhelmingly, like, grateful. And the look on their face, the gratitude, the body language, the just, those moments, I just didn't realize I could have that much of an impact on someone's life. That's what happened during those moments. And when I realized that I could give my life to those kinds of moments without even finishing college, like, why would I finish my psychology degree only to get another degree after to go into postgrad to maybe go into counseling to maybe impact people in that kind of way? Like, why would I invest that much money and time and energy to wait to postpone it to that far of a timeline when I could do it now, when I could just, you know, put a pause on everything and just start helping people in churches or homeless people or sick people? And that's actually ultimately what I did. I dropped out to do that. I dropped out for those kinds of moments that I was describing. Yeah. And so I ended up spending the next 3 years with a couple friends that were doing the same thing I was. And we essentially just lived off those highs of being able to impact people in a really grand way. And I built a whole network around it. I built a whole platform around it. Like, we blogged about our experiences, shared about our philosophy and insights about our experiences, and people started flying us out to different countries and wow, having us speak. It was a crazy ride, but yeah, that's in a really small nutshell, that's what I did in those 3 years. And then I realized that there's no money in this space, and I realized that a lot of people in the space that I was in, a lot of them are older, a lot of them have families, and I just thought that it was silly for a lot of well-intentioned people to not have funds to dedicate towards their cause. And so I thought, you know what, I'm young, I'm a blank slate, I'm probably one of the few people that see this problem and is willing to do something about it, so I'm going to go reinvent myself. And then that's when I spent a summer reading about business, investing, real estate, and then that's how I got into real estate.
How long did it take for you to get into a groove in real estate investing?
Okay, yeah, so I got into real estate investing because I bought one of those, like, guru programs, the ones that you probably either hear on the radio or are seeing on TV. Mm-hmm. That's how I got started. The one way that people advise you not to go through is the way that I got in. That was about 2.5 years ago. I dropped some money to join the program, and that's pretty much how I got started. Because I didn't know any other way. I didn't have any contacts. I didn't know anyone that was a business owner. I didn't know anyone that had a real estate business, let alone real estate investing. So that was the only option I was presented. So I'm like, whatever. I mean, let's go all in. And that's what I did. So
how do you make your first investment if you're just starting out like that and you've never done anything like it before?
Well, I mean, the program that I actually joined was actually legitimate in the sense that, like, they actually did teach a lot of foundational principles that are necessary in order for someone to start from zero and be somewhat successful in the real estate industry. The business model of what we do is we buy homes at about 80% of fair market value, and then we resell it at fair market. That's essentially what we do. Just like the same reason why, like, you would sell your guitar or your car or some electronic for below fair market is because for whatever reason you need cash. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason that cash is more valuable to you than getting full market value. And so if you just inflate that principle on like a 100x level, then now you have what I do, which is flipping houses. So I buy homes from people who, for whatever reason, they value cashing out in that moment more so than anything else. So they work with us. So purely based off of that, like, if I told you that if you could somehow come up with $800,000 to buy something that is worth $1 million, like, how many people do you think would jump on that idea? Like, anyone would, yeah. Right? Because that's, you're essentially making $200,000 out of thin air. So you just take that premise and then you pitch that to investors, and you have people who want to fund your deals. So that's pretty much it. So a lot of people who fund our transactions are like mom and pop investors, like our parents or family friends, or someone who's come, anyone who's got like 100,000-200,000 lying around would be a candidate to want to invest in what we're doing. And then there's more formal lenders out there that will fund these kinds of transactions that are inherently a little more risky. But yeah, there are lenders that build a business, entire business model out of lending to people who do exactly what I do. So
interesting. That's the first time I've heard of
yes.
a practice like that. I know people do flipping, but you see those like housing shows and you're like, that's not a real thing.
No. That just gave you the inside scoop on that entire industry. That is how those folks fund their deals. They don't use their own money. A lot of them don't use their own money, especially the serious players who do a lot of volume. They're all leveraging with these private lenders or hard money lenders that I essentially just explained to you about. So,
So what happens if the value of the home drops further from where fair market value was supposedly at?
Well, that's why we buy 80%, because you'd be hard pressed to find a market where homes will drop 20% in a matter of 3 months, 3 to 4 months, because that's usually how, worst case, how long it'll take for you to unload a property, even in like as is condition. Of course, it'll be different in different markets and whatnot, but unless we're going through like a Great Depression style crash, you're not going to have that kind of decline in the housing market. So in that sense, it's relatively calculated risk in terms of the venture that I'm in. So, mm-hmm. I mean, even if the market drops like 10% in 3 months, you're still at least able to break even without too much sweat. So, yeah.
You mentioned in the beginning that you were working on life values or your why. So how does the real estate investing relate to your why?
Yeah, good question. So backtrack a little, like I said, the reason why I left college in the first place was for those moments where doing something trivial, so that's seemingly trivial to me, can impact someone's life forever, and the amount of gratitude that comes out of it is so profound. And it's those moments that essentially drive my entire life now. It's like, that's the only reason why I can spend my entire life living for moments like that. And the thing is, it doesn't have to look like just explicitly working with churches or nonprofits or homeless or sick people. That actually looks, you can, like, people are stuck in all kinds of problems that and they need all kinds of solutions that can give them that kind of meaningful life change. And so initially I went into real estate because I wanted to address the funding issue of the nonprofit space. I wanted to build enough of a cash base or some kind of passive income in order to eventually go back and fund all these nonprofits I was working with. And so that's actually the main intent. But at this point, it's really just to get financial freedom so I don't have to ever work for the rest of my life after I'm done with real estate. And then on top of that, also have discretional funds to do with what I want in terms of my next venture, pursuing my next ventures or investing ideas, starting a new company or building an organization or whatever. The sky's the limit at that point. So real estate in itself, actually, I don't really care too much about, but it's the vehicle that I've ended up opting in for in order to get me to where I want to get.
You talked about reinventing yourself. Is there one on the horizon that you can see coming, or is it, like you said, waiting for that point where you're stable money-wise?
Well, so like the first time I reinvented myself was just getting into real estate. The first time, so that I was in that nonprofit space for about three and a half years, and that was all I knew. And because, I mean, I was in school before that, I was in high school before that, so that was really my only career at that point. And so I sort of climbed up to pretty dang close to the top in terms of what you can do in that space. I mean, I was being flown out to travel and speak, and that was phenomenal. And so my identity at that, in that sense, was wrapped up in the fact that I'm a speaker with these nonprofits. And me learning to let go of that identity and restart at zero was super integral in me sort of feeling like I could give myself permission to even change directions and then get into real estate. And so, yeah, I mean, that first experience definitely changed gave me a lot of perspective, and sort of is a template for how I'm going to go about doing my next thing. But in terms of what I see on the horizon, I think it's going to be a similar premise, where it's when I feel like I've pretty much reached dang near the top of what I can get to in this space, I think that's when I'm ready to move on. Or when I reach my financial goals, or, I don't know, maybe eventually I get fed up with the industry and there's another thing I want to develop or give myself to. I don't know. But I've tentatively planned for about investing about 5 to 7 years in this industry before I reinvent myself. Hmm. So I'm already 2.5 years in, so still a handful of years ahead of me. So
right. When somebody feels stuck, how do they get out of that situation? Is it you have to do the wipe the slate and just begin anew, or how do you plan for something where you want to change?
Well, get stuck in what sense?
Well, you said you felt you were at the top and you were stuck, like you were there and you couldn't do anything else in that space. So how do you make the decision to switch paths and reinvent yourself?
Well, I mean, it wasn't just that. I mean, I was feeling stuck because I wanted to do it at a larger scale, more so than anything else. It wasn't because I felt like I reached the top. I felt like because I was near the top, I felt like to go any further, I would need more. And I felt like I didn't have that component in order for me to get there. I felt like I could have done a lot more if I had some kind of funding to, I don't know, create some kind of branding, or, I don't know, create some kind of marketing, or, I don't know. I don't know, because I didn't know much at the time. I didn't have any framework for business or, like, sales funnels or email marketing. I didn't have any understanding or any grid for that. But I just knew that I was missing something that I knew could probably take me to a new level, and I knew I didn't have it, and I knew I wasn't going to find it in the space that I was in, because not everyone, most people in the nonprofit space, they don't care about personal development. They don't care about that much about learning and improving. They care about the cause that they have given their life to. Mm-hmm. And so because of that, I had to look outside. I knew I had to leave. Like I said, it wasn't because I got bored or stuck. It was because I felt like I needed one missing component, and I knew I wasn't going to find it there. So, it was a very unique situation. So where I'm at now, it's like I don't think I'm ever going to get stuck, because I know how to deal with the situation now. I know to intentionally look for mentors. I know to intentionally find people who have been there and done that. I know to find people who have gone before me and asked for their advice. So the ceiling got a lot higher for me, given where I'm at now. And so because I know how to reach out to other players, high performers in the industry, that sort of gives me a lot more lateral and freedom. And the only reason why I'll reinvent myself is because I simply am choosing to walk away, or I'm simply deciding, like, I've reached a point where there's sort of diminishing returns, and I want to do something different now. Mm-hmm. So,
gotcha.
I don't know. Yeah.
I was thinking more of the situation where a lot of people are in, and where they hate their job or whatever. But you were in a unique situation where that wasn't the case. You're just trying to leverage something else to come back to the previous situation and do what you want to on a larger scale, which is awesome.
Yeah.
How does go ahead.
Yeah, I think when it comes to people who are stuck in their job, it's I think there's two missing perspectives there. I think one is they don't understand what components they need to thrive in a working environment. And then two, they may not understand, I guess, what stage in life they're in or, like, stage of mastery that they're in. So, like, the first one, like, which is not understanding what makes them thrive. Like, at least for me, I base this on the whole self-determination theory where, like, you need autonomy, a sense of challenge, and a sense of belonging in order to feel like you can thrive in some environment. I know that those three concepts to be true in my life, where it's like, it doesn't matter as long as I have freedom to say when, where, how much, how often, how intense, and which is autonomy. As long as I have that, as long as I have the challenge where I'm constantly stretching and learning and growing, there's always something new, a new project to learn, a new project to tackle. As long as I don't feel like I'm so over my head that it feels impossible, but I'm constantly taking clear strides and I can constantly see the progress that I have. If I have the autonomy, the challenge, and feel like I'm working around good people that I can trust, that I can sort of have this team dynamic with, I don't actually care what I'm doing. As long as I believe, like, resonate with the vision that that organization has, like, I think I'm going to thrive there. So I think for most people, they don't take those things into account, like how important challenge is to their sense of fulfillment, or having autonomy is to their sense of fulfillment. Because they don't understand that, they sort of settle for the jobs that they have. Or they are very vague about the kind of careers that they're willing to go for. And so they'll settle with companies that don't have that kind of company culture. They don't give that much freedom. They don't they hardly do any kind of mentorship and growth. They don't fuel employees' personal development or give support for them to tackle bigger challenges, stuff like that. And if you don't have that framework, then in a sense, you don't know yourself. You don't know what makes you tick, so you don't even know what can make you fulfilled. So that's the first component. And then the second component is just realizing that, I mean, mastery is always takes time. And I mean, until we tend to be passionate about things because we're good at them, not because we like, oh wow, this tugs on all my heartstrings, and then you give your life to devoting yourself to that craft. It's usually the exact opposite, where like you get really good at something and then you realize that you enjoy having the freedom that comes with mastery, where it's like when you understand a subject so intuitively and in such an in-depth way, you're able to navigate that subject in so many dynamics, like back and forth, upside down, forwards and backwards, and you're able to apply those concepts, that skill set, that technical expertise in hundreds and hundreds of creative ways that are only possible because you've mastered that subject. In my experience, having that fun, that sort of passion, is a byproduct of reaching that level of mastery. And for a lot of people, they think that that should be the entire process, instead of realizing that it takes about 1 to 5 years of investment for you to get to that point where you are mastering it, so that you have that creative freedom, and that's where that fulfillment and passion comes.
What would you just suggest to somebody that hasn't found the thing that they're good at? Do you suggest they dabble in different things for that time period and try to figure it out, or how do you figure out what that is if you don't know what it is?
Well, like I think that's a well-intentioned question, but I think the way I think about it is usually when I see a master function. It's like someone who is very skilled, very technically skilled, or very talented in whatever aspect, whether it's in this particular skill or industry or talent or whatever. When I watch someone or see someone that's functioning at a very, very high level, and I think, wouldn't it be awesome to be able to do that? then that's enough for me to start taking steps to take those or pursue that interest. That's all, like that for me, that's all it is. Because all I know, because I know that the gap between where I stand and where that master is time. Time, practice, and investment. And so if, like, I don't know, like maybe you see some kind of actor that you like, you love the way they act, like you think they're the best actor on the planet. It's like, well, then take steps. If you think that their life would be that amazing, well, one, take the time to understand how much work it took for them to get there, and then two, see if you can replicate it. And then when you get there, then it's awesome. Obviously, like, that's super condensed, and I'm shortening all the learning curve that happens, the painful learning curve that happens in between. But, like, I mean, this is a very simple example. Like, I listen to a lot of acoustic music, whether it's piano, vocals, or guitar, because that's just sort of, I don't know, the music that I use for productivity or to relax. And so when I really like a song, I try to learn it, whether it's on guitar or piano. And I haven't played piano in like 10 years, but I'm in the process of learning All of Me by John Schmidt, one of the piano guys. Like, everyone knows piano guys, like the two piano dudes and the cellist guy. And one of them composed an original, and I freaking love the song. So I actually just bought a keyboard. No nice. Joke, I bought a keyboard this past weekend, and I've been practicing at home. And before I bought the keyboard, I was actually playing at my friend's house. Every single time I visited him, I would start practicing the song. But I sort of got tired of it, and now I'm practicing that song at home by myself. Hmm. So in terms of, like, would you say that I'm passionate about piano? Not to the point of being, like, a pianist, but I enough so that I'm willing to take those steps to invest in learning and playing songs that I enjoy, because I've already seen, like, I wish I could play that song. That song is so technically challenging and would be probably considered like a level 9 or 8 or 9 song based on like my piano history of all these like levels that you go through. Yet I'm learning it, and I didn't even finish level 4 when I was growing up in piano, learning piano. Hmm. So would you call that passion? I don't know. I mean, but it's a side interest, and I think if I master that song, I'm probably going to pick up another song, and eventually I'll have 2-3 songs that I can play that I really enjoy, and maybe people will eventually call me a pianist on the side. I don't know. Like, it's not something I'm pursuing. It's simply I like this thing, I'm pursuing it, and I don't know, maybe in 10 years, if all these other things that I'm doing sort of cool down, I don't know, maybe I will become a professional pianist. I don't know. Who knows, right? It's all up in the air to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, you self-identified as someone that doesn't want to, like, label themselves as any one thing, so it makes sense that you, if you want to play the piano, you're just going to play it. It's not like you want to be a pianist. You're just doing something that might be interesting to you at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, but just knowing human nature is like, people will eventually put labels on you, and you can either let it be a box, or you let it, you know, take it for what it is, which is just a label. So I never define myself by my labels, because, I mean, it doesn't do anyone a favor, but it's useful in that particular context. So I'll run with it. So, like, I mean, Kevin, are you a podcaster? When were you a podcaster? Were you a podcaster the moment you did the first podcast, or when you came up with the idea? Or were you a podcaster when it became socially accepted that you're a podcaster?
Right. There's really, it depends on the person, right?
Exactly. So what do you identify with? And why did you start doing it in the first place? Was it because you were in pursuit of the title, or was it because you found some value or found some genuine interest in it? Mm-hmm. Right?
Definitely.
So, yeah. So I think in general, people just need to feel like, I think a lot of people feel like they need to go all in on something in order to make something out of it. And it's entirely not true. Like, because I'm play piano like maybe, you know, 20 minutes a day. Like, I essentially work on one phase of the song each day. And over a period of a couple months, that translates into a pretty me being able to pretty fluently play an entire song. So I think people underestimate the power of just taking minute steps and incremental steps towards maybe seemingly lofty goals. So
there's a book, I believe it's Little Book of Talents or 52 Talents, but it goes into depth about like how you develop a talent, and there's many different components to becoming, I guess, a master at it. Let's see.
Yeah.
The Little Book of Talent 52 Tips. Yeah. Little I don't book. Know if you've read that one, but it's pretty good at
never,
breaking
no,
it down by the author Daniel Coyle.
Yeah, you can, I think, okay. I've read Art of Learning by Josh Weitzkin. I've read that section on 4-Hour Chef by Tim Ferriss about how to learn. Mm-hmm. So those two things sort of helped me understand the process of learning and sort of remove that sort of daunting feeling that if I'm trying to pursue something, I don't, you know, it just learn the basics and incrementally build up from there. So
have you watched the Tim Ferriss show? His
I haven't watched it. I've heard about it.
It is very interesting because it's exactly what you're talking about, where you take any interesting thing that you want to explore, and he does it in like 3 days. So he played with Foreigner after not knowing how to play anything on the drums before. He learned Tagalog, which is the Filipino language, and did an interview on the show, and then he learned parkour. And there's like, you're going to succeed or fail, which is not really the point. It's like, how do you dissect things?
Yeah, and I think understanding that specific process, how to dissect and knowing what to expect during the learning process was so foundational for me to feel so comfortable with trying something completely new that I've never done before. Like learning a new song for the first time, like with all these new frameworks, I had to it was so painful the first few times learning the song, but literally purely out of repetition, purely investing time, I went from a total retard on the piano to, oh wow, I can play the melody with my right hand now at 25% speed. But seeing that transition from that terrible uncomfortableness and awkwardness, that transferring, going from that phase to, oh shoot, I'm starting to finally get it. Like knowing that those two are very related and can happen in a very short amount of time is so encouraging and is a huge reason why I'm like so aggressive about learning things, because I know that uncomfortable stage is very, very short lived if I just push past that envelope. So,
You mentioned earlier, mentorship and being or seeking out mentors. Can you talk about the process or somebody that you sought and gotten guidance from?
I think James Altucher is the best role model of this. I mean, I'm stealing from his content because he's such a great communicator about this stuff. But he actually wrote this article called The Ultimate Cheat Sheet to Reinvent Yourself. And I would highly recommend anyone that's listening to this to check it out. It's on his blog. But he basically talks about how reinvention never stops, and you can pretty much learn from anyone and anything and anywhere. You can learn from books, movies, and TV, and the newspaper, from casual conversations. But when it comes to intentionally learning from mentors, it's like there's a lot of thought leaders out there. Just find the thought leaders, find whatever they've written, read everything they've ever written, and then once you've done everything they've ever written, start reaching out to them and tell them the results you've had as a result of reading their work, and then see if they're willing to help you move forward after that. That's essentially like the boiled down formula that I have. Find someone really good, do everything they've ever written about or instructed on regarding that niche, and then follow up, close the loop with them about all that progress, and they'll be more than happy to help you move forward.
Yeah, there's a bunch of things that I follow him heavily too, and one thing that he says is he reinvents himself like every 6 months. He's a completely different person.
Yeah.
And then he also does interviews after reading or digesting everything that that person has ever done. And once he has them on the podcast, he asks them questions that most people would never even think of.
Exactly. Yep.
So, highly recommend that.
That's exactly it, because people are more than happy, because once you take the time to see and recognize the work that they have already done and the time,
they don't want to waste their time with somebody that they don't know is going to do the work. Can you talk a little bit about the your writing practice and how you've gotten published on like Time and Mashable, and how you got to one of the top writers in Quora?
Oh man, it actually sounds a lot more glamorous than it really is, in my opinion. But I mean, I just started writing on Quora because I needed some kind of outlet to process. I actually write more for myself than anyone else, because I actually want to find out what I actually believe and what I actually think. And writing helps me crystallize in my mind what I actually believe. And it's just not as clear until I write it. And so I really do it for my sake. And so a lot of the writing that has been published, like some of the writing, I wrote it in like 10 minutes, like 10, 15 minutes. And some of the writing took me, I don't know, there's some writing that I took 3-4 days to write and it didn't get published. So I think when it comes to being published via Quora, in my opinion, I don't see it as that much of an accomplishment, because a lot of these media outlets, they're just looking for more traffic. They're looking for articles that drive traffic. And so a lot of these kinds of posts are like, you know, 5 reasons why you should do this, or like 7 reasons or 7 ways to do XYZ, you know, like, so a lot of the writing that I've gotten featured followed those lines of writing. And so it wasn't actually what, in my opinion, was not my best writing, and might not even be the most helpful writing. So, so unfortunately, sort of, I don't know if I burst the bubble here, but,
I was just curious.
Yeah, no, it was just purely writing. I was writing like 3 answers a day on Quora, and eventually someone on staff said, hey, we're thinking about using this piece for, Time or Ink. And like, do we have your permission? And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And then that was it. It wasn't anything grandiose, and it wasn't anything I even expected. It was just, I was writing the best content that I could, and apparently it was good enough to put on these kind of traffic portals. So,
have you seen any results from having it in those places?
Well, like I said, I'm not building an audience right now explicitly. I'm not looking, nor am I tracking, or am I aware of any kind of ROI, because there simply isn't any, other than the fact that I can say, oh, I'm, you know, featured on, you know, Time or Mashable. It's a nice credibility booster, but at the end of the day, it hasn't translated into any opportunity that I'm aware of. So, yeah.
Interesting. Because a lot of people seek out writing on these places, and somehow you found the secret formula without even trying to.
I know. I'm sure people are jealous. But, I mean, there's a guy named Nicholas Cole on Quora. He's a really cool dude. He's actually got a very his story is actually very similar to mine. He's actually the same age as me as well, and we connect a lot. But he pretty much hacked the entire Quora, like, media outlet formula. Like, he's had at least 20 articles featured in all those media outlets, like Time Magazine, Business Insider, Huffington Post. Like, he gets published on a regular basis because he follows that same protocol. All of his articles are in the format of 5 bullet points, like literally every single one. He writes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and writes a pretty cool blurb about whatever he's writing about, and then he gets published like on a regular basis. So I think it's this, in this particular aspect, it's really just knowing how the game is being played. And the game that's being played is you got to write those clickbait titled articles that like 5 ways, 10 ways, whatever. And it just turns out that Quora is a great platform because Quora doesn't have a business model yet, and they're trying to build relationships with these big media giants. So they essentially do the promotion for you. And so you don't have to solicit these media outlets on your own. You can just piggyback on Quora's on Quora's platform. So it's free for anyone to do. So have at it.
Yeah. I write occasionally answers because I'm writing answers on creativity and art, and I've seen it a little bit. But it's just to, like you said, get your ideas out there and write for yourself and see what you actually think, as opposed to, this is going to gain me a lot of people following me.
Yeah. Yeah, I never write. I never write to try to get views. I write because I'm trying to help my audience. My writing process, how I approach my writing, is I write to answer a specific question or help someone with a particular issue. And the views are sort of an indicator of whether I wrote something that resonated or not. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
A good example of someone who also did not intend to do that is Marcus Aurelius in Meditations.
Oh, really? Okay.
That was a book that he wrote for himself that he never intended to publish to people, and I guess they found it after he died. And
oh, wow. I didn't know that.
And at that point, it became this thing that people could read. It was like notes to himself,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty interesting. I think Ryan Holiday talked about that.
Okay. Cool. Yeah, I had no idea. I didn't know.
So what are examples of some of the posts that you thought were really good that didn't get any traction and the ones that did?
Like one of the very first answers that I wrote was a comprehensive answer in terms of my journey of understanding confidence and how I learned to be confident. It was the most comprehensive piece of writing I've ever done on that subject. And to this day, it only has less than like 10,000 views, maybe like 100 upvotes. Whereas like my most upvoted thing was this post on creativity that I churned out when I was lying down in bed, and it took me like 20 minutes. And that thing has like 500,000 views and like 6,000 upvotes. So there's upvotes does not mean quality, in my opinion. And so that post that I wrote, I spent at least 2 days writing about it. The TLDR was basically, I used to be super insecure, but I climbed out of it, and it was like a 2 to 3 year journey, basically when I first went into college, starting right in the middle of high school to when I first started college. And it wasn't, none of those were like tactics on how I came to act confident. Like I actually became confident in who I was and how I saw myself. So
what are your plans as far as being able to have that larger platform you were talking about to help more people on a larger scale than you were before?
Honestly, I haven't taken the time to dig into that because I'm more concerned about just getting there first. I think it's more important, at least for me, to actually get to that place where I even can do something about it before I put a lot of thought into it. Because I already know the gist of it. I know the theme that is going to ride along, but I just don't know what it specifically will look like in the nitty gritty. So I don't really plan. I have some vague ideas, but it's constantly changing given the experiences that I have, the people I meet, the skills that I learn, et cetera, et cetera. So I know it's going to be constantly changing over the next few years, so I don't try to put a definitive picture on how it's going to look.
I think that speaks to the idea of living in the present moment as opposed to living for the future. Because you don't know what's going to happen, how you're going to evolve, what's going to change. Like James Altman says, you change every 6 months.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, how many times have you planned for something, like, 5 years down and realize, like, even 2 years in, you're like, holy crap, what I anticipated is nothing like what I thought it would be. Like, when I first started in real estate, I thought I was going to be, like, killing it in 2 years, like, freaking on TV or, like, not that extreme, but, like, I thought I was going to be doing really well in 2 years. And I'm 2.5 years in, and I know the reality now, where it's, like, you can do really well, but not the way I was thinking. Like, I didn't realize the things that I was going to learn either. I thought it was a lot more straightforward, and I realized the industry is so much more complex. So yeah, I mean, absolutely, completely agree. Everything's constantly changing. It's really hard to anticipate where you're going to be. So,
what were some of your expectations, and what are like the differences in reality?
Well, it's just what I told you already. I expected to be pretty dang successful in 2 years. And I just didn't realize how much actually went into this whole aspect of real estate investing, how nitty gritty things could get, how complicated things could get, and how vast the industry was. So I really just underestimated how much opportunity and how deep and vast the subject was. So, like, even now, it's like, if I think about reinventing myself and say, I don't know, going into law or going into education or going into, I don't know, building a platform for myself, like, I'm probably only have like a very vague idea of what actually goes into it. And until I start going through it, or at least talk to people that are in it, I'm not going to really know what my expectations are definitely going to have a high disparity between what I'm going to go through if I go into it. So that's why there's the value in the mentorship. So finding people who have already been there and done that, that are able to sort of give you the real DL on what to expect and what the industry or what that thing that I'm pursuing is actually going to look like. Mm-hmm. So,
can you talk a little bit about your speaking opportunities and kind of what you talked about while you were traveling and speaking to people?
Yeah, actually, it was a lot on that 3-year journey that I had in terms of confidence. The gist of what I talked about really comes down to the fact that how you see yourself affects how you see other people, and therefore how you treat people and how you interact with people. And so if you're functioning from a place of insecurity and wanting attention and wanting to be seen and wanting to be known, all your actions and interactions with people are going to have that undertone. They're going to have that little discoloration of that insecurity in your life. And so when you're able to address that, the opposite is also true, where when you have that address and you're coming from this place of confidence where you don't actually need anything from anyone, it completely changes how you operate with people and how you interact with people and the intentions behind why you interact with people. And those little subtle intentions, in my opinion, have largely helped me get to where I am today, and are far more integral into me getting to where I am today than I think most people would give it credit for. I personally think having that foundation is like the 80-20 to why I am here today, where I'm at. So a lot of what I talked about was specifically in the nonprofit, Christian perspective, how to actually go about doing that. Because that was the niche that I was in, so everything was in the context of Christianity and the nonprofits that I was working with. So I framed identity and confidence in that sort of theological, framework. Yeah.
It's all about knowing your audience and who you're speaking to and how you can speak to them in the way that they are familiar with and resonate with, I think.
Yes. So in retrospect, I would fully agree with what you're saying because I was doing all that intuitively at the time, because like I said, I didn't have any background. I didn't have any understanding about business on any level. Like I was pretty much just fresh out of high school. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know anything. All those experiences I did in nonprofit, building an audience, like in retrospect, I did almost everything right. But it was never I didn't do it because I knew it was the right thing to do. I did it because I was actually just trying to help people. And it turns out if you're just driven to do that, help people at your highest and best, and you're constantly improving to develop, to like help more people as more or more effectively, faster, get more results that way. Like, it has nothing to do with profit. It's just I want to be more efficient and more effective at helping people. Turns out that leads to me being the highest and best at what I was doing. And yeah.
That's crazy how it worked out.
Yeah. No, yeah, and I deeply understood my audience, like, no joke. Like, I actually, it's so crazy how I intuitively did this, but I actually created a survey to ask my audience, the people that were following my blog, my YouTube channel, what are the issues that are, like, most pressing issues that you're wrestling with in your life in this context that is currently not being addressed by your local community? Like, I got really specific, and I made them anonymous surveys. And that gave me a lot of deep insight in terms of the language that people had, the specific issues, specific pain points. And I actually crafted my message with their language. And I did all of this intuitively, purely because I just wanted to be better at helping people out of their problem. It was crazy.
Wow. Yeah.
I know.
Now that you look back, you're like, whoa, I did everything the right way.
Even though
no one taught me this.
I know. It's crazy.
Awesome. That's cool.
So it turns out those principles actually work. They're very effective.
just by testing them, I guess, you figured that out on your own.
Yeah. No, actually, I mean, that's why I fully resonate with J. Abraham's philosophy. I don't know if you've ever at least listened to his strategy of preeminence. His strategy of preeminence completely defined what I was doing in nonprofit. And I didn't actually realize I could take that exact same philosophy and apply it in business. And that's why I'm so, that's why I love J. Abraham. I read all his stuff. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've listened to a couple of interviews that he's done, and there's definitely some cool insights. Like, one of the things that he did was take the 3-star Amazon book reviews and tailor his content to fit what people were saying were wrong with books that were already out there.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
It's crazy the way that that guy thinks.
Yeah.
I have a few more questions left. The first is, do you have a morning routine? And if you do, what is it?
My morning routine is spend the first hour reading or writing, and then, depending on my schedule, a breakfast, and then I head to my either morning meetings or just go to the office or run my errands. But it's always hour of reading or writing and then breakfast.
So is the reading related to what you're currently trying to learn and the writing tailored to, like, Quora or one of those things? Or is it, like, how do you pick what to do that more?
It's a free-for-all. The whole intention is just to I heard one of my friends said you should pay yourself first, and so that's why you should dedicate the first hour of the day to investing in yourself. And so whether that is reading something that's technically going to improve your business or for personal development, it doesn't matter. Or whether you're writing to build your audience or to help you think or to journal, whatever, it doesn't matter. The whole point is, for me, the first hour I'm paying myself, because a lot of us sort of neglect that, and we sort of we give ourselves the scraps of our day, and we give work or a career or a business our best, and then by the time we get home, we don't pay ourselves anything because we're all too tired and don't have any more energy. So
that's
the main gist. Yeah.
I used to wake up, eat breakfast, and then leave for work. But I've since done the thing where I wake up an hour earlier than I used to and get the reading and the writing and all that stuff for yourself done first before dedicating your time to somebody else. And it's been, like, hugely effective.
Definitely.
Well, what are some books or resources that you would recommend for people, particularly on the subject of creativity?
I actually haven't read anything on creativity. I haven't read any formal resource on creativity. It's more so purely based on glimpses here and there and personal experience. So, I mean, I was a musician most of my life. I mean, I studied piano until I was 8, and then I picked up trumpet when I was in like 5th grade, played trumpet and French horn throughout high school, and then I played jazz 1 year in high school. And then outside of that, I played guitar. At one point, I started composing on guitar. Another point, I started composing on piano. I composed like one song on piano during that time frame when I'm just trying to learn songs recently. And so it was really just during those processes that I learned to piece together, talk to other musicians, talk to other creatives about the creative process, because I could relate, because I learned to compose sort of just by tinkering. And so a lot of my creative understanding is at least now, it's pretty much synonymous with play and rest, and not filtering yourself, because writing is also a very creative process. So when I write, I try to remove every filter. I just splurt it out. And the way James Altucher describes it is you just throw it all out there, and then you sculpt. Just throw everything out there, and then it's a process of refining, making it better, slowly chipping it away. And that's pretty much my creative process now. It's just I essentially brain vomit. I just puke. It's like a mental puke. And then whatever I think is really good or worth keeping, I keep it. And then everything else I scrap. And then you just keep. It's just rinse, wash, repeat from there. That's how I understand my creative process at this point.
What do you have any recommendations on books outside of creativity, on like personal development or growth, or any of those things?
Oh, outside of creativity?
Yeah.
Shoot, you gotta get more specific, man. This is a lot. I don't know.
Well, like, what is the most recent book that has had like a significant impact on what you're doing?
Significant impact. I think I'm reading Thinking Fast and Slow right now. I think that's one of the most recent books that has connected a lot of dots for me. Pretty much every 2 to 3 pages, I have to pause and connect all the dots that they just presented to every single other aspect in my life. There's very few books that make, like, essentially force me to stop reading if I really want to digest it. So that's been a recent good one. I recently read Elon Musk's biography, but that's more for personal experience, because I want to understand the psychology of someone who has built a $1 billion empire. I think the most standout books for me that I would say like define me would be, I think Tuesdays with Maury is one. I think Give and Take is another, by Adam Grant. I think those two stand out the most in my mind.
Cool.
In terms of books that really define me.
Right. Did you read Justine Musk's article on Elon, where she explains how you can be like Steve Jobs or Elon Musk?
Yes. I printed it out, and that's my manifesto.
Nice. That's awesome.
I actually messaged her after she wrote that. I'm like, this is my manifesto. Thank you for writing this.
Did she respond back?
Yeah, she did. I forgot what she said. It was just some line of encouragement. And she's like, keep at it, or something like that.
Very cool.
Who
is somebody that you personally know that is extremely creative, and then maybe somebody that you don't personally know that you think is creative?
Sorry, say again. Who is someone what I know?
You personally know that is creative, and then somebody that you don't personally know.
Okay. Who is someone I personally know that is creative? Frick. I don't know. In what sense? Because
in whatever sense that is beneficial to you.
I take it. Okay. I mean, that's hard.
You can like, come back
I have
to
a
that
friend.
One.
Yeah, like personally, no. Like that's tough. Because in my opinion, like creativity is a synergy between mastery and freedom. Because once you master something, like the mastery aspect enhances your ability to express yourself. Uh-huh. And so mastery amplifies it, but the biggest aspect of it is just being able to freely play and express and just go with what comes up. And so I know like drunk people are very creative. And I know some people that like the things they say are just mind-blowing and hilarious, how they piece together those two thoughts, because when they're sober they could never do that, right? So in those, like those people, like those are a trip, and they're like a spectacle of creativity, and it's just amazing to watch the people that are like that. And then I have friends that are professional musicians or dancers, and like they have their whole life is creative. Everything's flowy, and they're always expressing themselves. And this is how they talk, and this is their tonality, because everything just goes with the flow. And it's that's another form of creativity. And there's things I can take away from that too. So I don't know. Like it's a tough question, because I think creativity is such a fluid topic. And there's so many ways you can apply it. Like my mentor, he is the best that I am aware of in doing creative real estate transactions. Like that sounds like a weird thing to say, but that's actually a topic of conversation in our industry, which is creative financing or creative deal structuring. And that only happens because you have some realm of expertise. Or actually a very high level of expertise and a mode of thinking differently compared to the average person. And so you're able to see, connect dots that no one else is able to connect. So creativity looks like there's so many different applications and extrapolations you can make. So it's, yeah, I'm having trouble.
That kind of.
Hopefully that was good enough though.
I understand where you're going, because it kind of ties into my last question, which is, what is your definition of creativity? I know you talked about this a little bit. And then what can people do? So you talked a little bit about both of these, but yeah. I just want to further define them.
Yeah, I mean, creativity is being able to express yourself freely. And then, but when you're able to like have some level of technical mastery in that form of expression, that's when it amplifies. That's when people can stand back and actually admire it. When people can admire some kind of great craft, or like that person, like he's good at that. He's like the best in that. That only happens when you add that mastery part. Because babies are creative. Little kids are very creative. But it's really when you add a huge technical expertise and mastery in that, where people become very enamored and almost like worship their talent. Uh-huh. And it's that having that where freedom to express yourself meets with mastery. I think that's where you have the magic happen. So
cool. That's awesome. That's the first time I've heard it explained like that, and that's a very good insight, because.
Oh, really? Yeah. What else do people say?
I've gotten a whole slew of answers. It's like
I'm sure.
Being able to play, being able to let go, combining multiple aspects of different things. But I don't think anyone's ever added the additional aspect of mastery to it in order to get to the next level of creativity. That's cool.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's because I just have a very interesting background. I mean, being a musician is like my background as a musician is, I think, the most defining aspect of why I defined it like that, because jazz, I think, is the epitome of that, or it's just a very good example of that, because when you improv and you don't have technical mastery in that instrument, you are terrible at improv. But if you are actually, like, if you understand every single mode and how to dance between modes and know all your scales inside and out, and then you're able to blend that in the flavor of the moment with that song, with the style, with the percussion, with the bass, with the chord progression, that is the epitome of self-expression with mastery. Like, I don't know. I'm forever impressed by musicians who can improv very fluently and in a pleasing way, in a way that is pleasing to the ear. That's just my mind is blown by it, because I've been in that space and I know how technically challenging that actually is. So that's the context for it.
Yeah, I'm particularly a fan of blues, improvised blues.
Yeah,
those guys can just go at it for hours at a time, just playing something that comes off the top of their head, and they're like, "Where does this come from?" It's different every time.
Yeah, but it's all layered. It's all superimposed over their technical mastery, and so they have complete freedom in their technical mastery, and that's where the beauty happens. That's where the magic happens.
Yeah, I think B.B. King talked about he only knows a few certain things, but being able to combine them is how he was able to like come up with the music that he created.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Brandon, this has been really awesome talking to you. I've had a lot of fun here.
Yeah, hopefully it's been valuable.
Yeah, for sure. Cool. Yeah. Where can people find you or keep up to date? I know you're not trying to build your brand, but in case people are interested in possibly reading your articles or whatever.
Yeah, I think the main way is just follow me on Quora. I guess quora.com, and then look up Brandon Lee, because there's only one Brandon Lee that's also a top writer.
Cool.
So I think that's the only way to go, the easiest way to go about it. Or just Google Quora Brandon Lee, you'll probably come across my stuff.
I think that's how I kept on finding you, because I didn't like bookmark the page or anything. So
I think you
will come up number one. Well, cool. Well, thanks again for chatting here.
Yeah, my pleasure. Happy to do that.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right, man.
And that's it for the 36th episode of Cracking Creativity. For show notes, go to crackingcreativity.org/36. If you like this episode, subscribe to the show on iTunes at crackingcreativity.org/subscribe. Also, feel free to write a review or leave me a comment about the show. Hope this stoked your creative fires, and I'll see you next time on Cracking Creativity.